This episode of Talking to Mod is sponsored by Sam's Barbershop in Northern Ireland. Not only can you get a haircut to look like an ace face, you can also dress like one too. Upstairs, they have a wide range of men's and women's clothing to suit you for any occasion. So what are you waiting for? Go check them out. How are we doing, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Talking to Mod. This week we have the very talented Ricky Mamie. I met Ricky when I was on tour with the Brian Jonestown Massacre, as he's part of that fantastic band. So this is going to be an epic chat. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Talking to Mod. Oh, yes, Ricky.
Hello.
How are you, man?
Yeah, I'm all right. How are you?
Very well. Good to see you, my friend. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Yeah, I'm just, getting my day started here in California.
What's the time there?
It's noon. Yeah.
Oh, wow, man.
Late start.
That's mad. How are you, though? You all well and good?
Yeah, I'm all right. I'm just, being a lazy California flower child, just rolling the smoke here and having a cup of tea.
Wait, it was a bit like being on tour again.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just everyday life, I'm listening to the Bedazzled soundtrack, Peter Cook and Dudley Moore,
Brilliant, man, brilliant.
Good music for the morning.
See, do you know what, right? I often think about this. That's one thing I do miss. I mean, there's a lot of things I miss about that whole tour in general, but it's when we had a late night and people would be playing random music, and I was discovering so many artists and who I've never heard of before. And it was like a lesson in music. It was just wonderful.
Yeah. Well, all of us in our own way have an interest in focusing on things that aren't mainstream, or even hip, for that matter, even though we kind of come off as this sort of hipster band, that's not really our focus. We're kind of into things that are sort of decidedly unhip for the most part, certainly in our own listening tastes, I'm listening to Jim Dale and Jake Thackeray and Dudley Moore. I listen to all this old shit lately, the tastes. You want to listen to the things that don't seem like they should actually be that interesting, but then they prove to be very interesting because they're not sort of presented to you as cool or hip or stylish. They're just sort of presented to you as old and square and, music my grandparents would have liked or kind of that kind of thing, right? So, a lot of this music from the 60s that was dubbed as square, all of it sounds fucking great to me. All of it sounds better than anything you're going to hear from anyone now. So even the most uncoolest square thing, from the 60s is somehow way fucking cooler than whoever the so-called coolest people are of the day now,
I remember Anton gave me one rule, and he said on the tour bus, he said, no Oasis. And I was like, I ain't fucking with you. I'm not gonna be playing any of that.
Yeah, it's pretty rare that you're going to hear us listening to anything contemporary or modern. And if we are, it's probably something that we're either working on with somebody or something that's so from left field. I got really into Chinese post-punk underground bands, because it just seemed so, first of all, how could this even exist? Second of all, how good could it be? And all these reasons why it shouldn't make sense are what's intriguing about it and makes me interested. And then through doing the research, I found that it was all very exceptionally high quality stuff that you're really not going to find out about unless you do the research, do the work. You have to be enthusiastic, you have to be interested, and that requires critical thought and and initiative and motivation. And, you know, people just aren't that way anymore. People, they're so, you know, overloaded by just what's coming off their phone that they don't even have a chance to think for themselves. You know, they're not even making a decision for themselves because media is making it all for them, right? So the idea of thinking for yourself and making your own conclusions and having your own ideas about what's cool, inventing cool for yourself, that's blown out of the water. That's not happening. You know, whereas back in the day, that was the only way cool existed, was making it for yourself, because it wasn't being prepackaged for you. It wasn't being marketed to you. It was something you had to find for yourself and create for yourself, invent out of nothing for yourself, right? That's the fundamental difference between what made something cool back in the old days, the 50s or 60s or earlier even, versus now, where everything is just pre-commodified and sub-genred to the max.
Yeah.
You know, and now, and people raise their hands for it. Like, yeah, I'll sign up for a Spotify account and it'll just tell me what to listen to based on these couple of things I told it about what I like. And suddenly I'm just being served a shit sandwich all day long, you know, because the media thinks has decided that's what I want or whatever. You know, it's a whole other playing field. So people have to take power back by thinking for themselves, which means disengaging from social media and certainly disengaging from anything that's going to create a fucking playlist for you based on your algorithmic behavior or whatever. You know, what the fuck is that about? There's nothing rock and roll about being surveyed when you're listening to music. I mean, come on. You know, you're supposed to be listening to music that's too far out for the world. You had to close the doors and make sure the right people are in the room or something, you know. The same for everybody, right?
100%.
So, yeah, and that's what I think we need to take back to, actually. You know, everything is not for everyone, nor should it be. You know, that's the homogenization. That's that whole that's the downside of the one world mentality, where it's like, oh, we're all the same. It's like, maybe that's not such a good idea, actually, because if we're all the fucking same, then what is there to talk about anymore? So let's all be different and celebrate diversity and the fact that we're all totally fucking unique in and unto of ourselves. You know, we don't need to be like everyone else or be pre-approved by some pre-existing group of people that all have a matching haircut or matching boots or whatever, matching lip liner or whatever the fuck it is. You know, it's, you know, church of this, church of that, take your pick, right?
100%, man. I think a lot of people as well are a bit too, maybe I wouldn't say too shy, but they don't want to get out of their box. They're too maybe scared of being different because they want to
lily livered. Yeah, they're all mollycoddled all until middle age, and they, you know, people have no fucking balls, to put it bluntly. I mean, come on. And that's the thing. People feel like they don't have to have balls because they can just have balls vicariously through some rock and roll fantasy or some shit. You know, so, no, fuck that. Go get a real fucking pair for yourself, mate.
100%. You see,
honestly, I was going to hand you your own balls. You got to make them, dude. Right, it's just a figure of speech, you know, dude, balls, whatever. I'm just saying, like, you have to find your strength. Whether you're a man or a woman or you got balls or not, it's not about that. It's about deciding. It's about taking the power for yourself, making your own freedom. Starting with 100%. How you fucking think and how you act and how you behave and how you proceed and go forth in the world, right? It's not saying you have to be an outlaw or a criminal, but you also don't have to take any fucking shit either.
100%, man.
Strike the balance, right?
I think, as you mentioned at the beginning, though, social media has sort of got a chokehold on so many people because their news these days is literally social media. They go on social media and they go, oh, well, it's on Twitter, so it must be real. And then next thing you know, they're talking about something that they haven't got a clue about. And
when that's your idea of getting good news, that's like your idea of a good dinner is having, you know, chicken McNuggets, right? So it's like, it's the same thing. It's like the quick fix. Well, I'm not starving anymore. You know, well, I got some details. You know, I didn't get a good critique. I just got the short of it, and that's good enough for me. I'll run on that. I'll operate on the short of it. And that's the mentality we're up against these days. Again, back to the critical thought. No one's interested in why the answers to the test are correct. They just want the correct answers. They'll pay for them. Give me the answers. I'll cheat. I'll look over your shoulder and cheat and get the answers off of you, and I'll pass my test. And I won't even know why these answers are right. If someone asks me why it's right, I won't be able to tell them. But that's okay. I'll still get by on the fact that I knew what the answer was, right? And this is what we're up against. This is the modern day culture. People don't want to do the hard yards. They just want all the reward without any of the work. And that's a bad state of things as a culture, as a society. Think about it. When people don't want to earn what they have, they just want to go out and take it or have it or have it handed to them. You know, they want to wake up on the sofa famous or whatever. You know, it doesn't bode well for the future.
That's it though, isn't it? You just mentioned that they want to wake up famous. I mean, these days people think that they could put something out on the internet and then the next day it's just going to blow up, and then they think, oh, they put a gig on and won't have to promote it, people will turn up. It's not like that.
And social media encourages this la-la land way of thinking, and that's got to stop. People got to get out there and actually do the fucking work again. They got to go hang up flyers on telephone poles that they're not allowed to be hanging them up on and all that shit like we used to fucking do in the 80s and 90s. Gee, are we going to get cops coming to the gig because we put posters on this fucking wall over some other poster or whatever? You know, we would deface billboards like Newport cigarette ads and shit and turn it into a flyer for our gig. So, you know, you got to get creative and you got to think outside the box and you got to find ways to really be compelling. I mean, if you're trying to make something happen publicly in any way, and if you're trying to make it as a band or make it as some kind of something worthy, genuinely worthy of people's attention, short of getting the $20,000 package deal from some New York publicist to make the whole world know who you are on the same day at the same time, you know, like clockwork. Fuck that. You got to do it yourself. You know, anyone can be famous. I mean, just look at Kim Kardashian. If you've got the money, you can have the whole world talking about you for no 100%. Reason at all other than they know what your name is.
Do you know, honestly, this is just taking me back to times on the tour bus with you guys, and we were talking about absolutely everything. And you know what, right?
Yeah,
I've never experienced a band like it, Ricky. Like, it was every day I learned something. Do you know what I mean? Like, every day, it was like, as soon as I woke up, right, what are we going to learn today? If it wasn't music, it was something else. And it's just, I'm telling you now, I mean, you know it yourself. There just isn't another band like that ever. I've never seen another band like that in my life.
I guess I wouldn't really know, you know? I mean, not that I don't work with other people, but I don't really work with other people in such an acute manner for extended periods, you know, on a tour bus for months or whatever. So, yeah, it's our universe works the way it does, and we're all, you know, we have to kind of stay sharp, you know, for a number of reasons, but it's also part of what keeps us going, you know, is being aware and being astute and discussing many different ways of understanding things and believing things and all that stuff. So yeah, there's a lot of philosophical conversation that takes place, and a lot of, again, decidedly non-rock and roll shit going on. You know, I mean, sure, we're drinking and smoking or whatever, but we're not really behaving poorly. We're just kind of, yeah, talking about humanity. It's all the great big humanity discussion, usually all night long somehow.
I mean, I classed myself as one of the luckiest people in the world, and that is because not only did I get to share the tour bus with you guys for about 3 weeks, I think it was, wasn't it?
But it was a long time, yeah.
Yeah, I was literally part of the family.
Well, yeah, and that's kind of how it has to be. You know, you can't have it any other way. When you have an echelon system of I'm up here and you're down there, you're just going to create problems. Mm. For yourself, for the other people, and then you're creating situations that have to be explained or understood, and that's bullshit. The best thing to do is to have everyone on a level, like we're all in the same sinking boat together. So don't be a fucking drag, and we'll all sink gently together. You know, and it won't be anyone's fault. We won't have to scapegoat anyone. You never want to be, you know, that guy. You don't want to be the scapegoat. So it's just again, staying sharp. like I was saying, you really have to stay sharp. And that's part of it, is just knowing how to maintain yourself in a situation like that, where you have to continue to get along with people who are actually your good mates. But just because they're your good mates doesn't mean you're just going to get along automatically all day, every day. You have to work at that. You have to make sure that you're contributing to the situation in a way that appeals to everyone's better nature, you know, and therefore sparks the same kind of reaction. So everyone is dealing with one another in that way, you know, we're being sensitive to one another. And the fact that, you know, we have, you know, needs and problems and less than perfect subprime situations in our lives, often as a result of being on tour. So, you know, so we're pretty, usually pretty respectful of one another, you know, on that level, you know, we're just like.
No, it was amazing. As I said, like, I do class myself as lucky, because not only did I get to share the tour bus, I also got to see you guys in soundcheck. And then for about 18, 19 shows, whatever it was, I also got to see the show as well. And I was just standing. And no nights were the same. Every night was different. Mm. And that's what I loved, because even though, yeah, as I said, I watched it from day one of the tour to the last day of the tour, no two gigs were the same. And for me, it was like I was at a different gig every night. It was absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I like and that. I mean, I know what you mean. And that's one of the things that keeps me interested in it, actually, aside from the personal stuff. But just, I do like just to, I like to be interested in what I'm doing, you know, otherwise I don't want to do it. So that's one of the things that keeps me interested, is the fact that every time we come at it, somehow there's some revelatory thing, no matter how subtle or abstract, that makes me go, oh wow, you know, this is interesting, this is exciting, there is something magical in this minimalist discipline that we've employed for so long now. And even through trying to just keep it simple, you know, you can never know these songs well enough. You know, we can play a song like Servo, which is just three chords round and round. But, you know, after playing it on the road for 20 years, we still go in the rehearsal room and play it and find that there's a way to play it even better. The same three chords that go round and round. See what I mean? So it's like, you know, you don't just, if you want to be fit, you don't just go to the gym one day and be like, okay, well, been there, done that. You gotta make a life of it, you know? So it's, you know, you're playing these three chord round and round songs, and they're kind of just like this meditative thing that goes round and round with a beat and a progression. But, you know, you can tell yourself you've got it down, and you know, like the back of your hand, and maybe you do, but that doesn't mean there isn't still the room to improve it, to know it even better, to understand it even better, and therefore how to deliver it even better. So we're always looking for these ways to improve, no matter how incremental, no matter how subtle, no matter how much no one notices but us. We're always looking for these ways to do it, you know, because that's just what has to happen in anything in life, right?
Do you have a favorite song that you like to play? Like when you're live and that, is there one that comes up?
With those guys?
Yeah.
That's hard to say, you know, because
it changes so
much. Yeah. I mean, to be fair, a lot of my most favorite ones to play, we probably haven't played in 10 years or so. But, you know, that's okay. That's also kind of interesting, too, in a way, because you have to find the inspiration and the sort of new delivery of things. And that's been fine. I do find a lot of enjoyment in playing the newer material. Whatever's new at the time seems to be what I'll enjoy the most, because you have to rise to it in a different way, because you don't have as many piloting hours playing it. It's a newer experience, so you got to kind of, there's more immediacy as a result, somehow a different kind of immediacy. So I'm genuinely pretty happy when the set is heavy on the new stuff. You know, not that I don't like the old stuff, but I feel like most people who come to see us have seen us do that. And it's better to, I always err on the side of, it's better to see a band do what they're inspired to do than what you feel like they should do. So just let us do what we've decided is going to be the best thing, and that's definitely going to be the best thing. You start telling us what songs to play, it's just like, well,
I'm not a busker.
Well, you know, it's like when you're DJing and someone comes up to you and it's like, oh, it's my friend's 18th, play some Radiohead. And you're just like, mate, they didn't ask me to DJ here to play Radiohead for your friend's 18th fucking birthday, man. I don't even have that record. You know what I say? I say, I'll bet you got that record at home, don't you? Why don't you go home and listen to whatever the fuck you want? What are you doing out here? You're not here to tell me what to play?
Fuck that.
But again, there you go with people and their entitlement again. And that's back to this shit we're talking about, where it's all about me, me, me. I know so because my Facebook profile tells me so. So, or whatever, you know. So they go out and act that way, you know. Like, oh, you're the DJ? That means you're my DJ. That means you're going to play this Radiohead record or whatever. Just picking the name out of a hat, but you know,
fucking madness. I tell you one thing else that stood out for me on that tour, and that is the fans. I've never seen such a loyal fan base in my life. Like there was one lady, and I think she ended up coming to about 8 or 9 shows on the whole tour. Right, yeah, I ended up seeing her. There was so many. I was like, hang about, am I tripping? Were you at the first one? Were you like, what's going on here? And then there was one woman.
Yeah, we've got this army of clones.
It's they're honestly
they're drone clone AI people. No, sorry, they're just people who are really into it, man. And you know, you gotta, when we first started having that experience of like, oh, there's that person again. It's hard to have that experience and not feel a little creeped out by it at first, because you just don't know. But over time, you start to realize, wow, these people, they're investing their time. They're investing their money. They're really passionate about this. You know, I can think that's a bit bonkers, but man, it's really a thing for them and it's keeping them going. So fair play. And who am I to fucking be any other way than appreciative of all of that. So you learn to respect these people, actually. It doesn't mean you need to be their best mate. It just means, you know, you appreciate them. You're glad. You're glad that they're voting with their time and their money in such a way, you know, and because they don't have to do that at all. No one does, especially the way things are now. I mean, you know, everyone's got such a short attention span these days, you know, and they want instant gratification and all that shit. So, you know, I'm glad for the fans like that. And I've seen it before. I remember coming to the UK in the 80s and, you know, talking to friends who they're like, oh, yeah, I just went and saw all 20 of the Wonder Stuff gigs on their tour. You know, you went on the tour, right? Yeah, oh, yeah, we went on the whole tour. Like, that wasn't so unusual. You know, you'd meet, I remember guys, I knew guys who would go do that with the Mission UK. They do that with The Mission. They do that with the Wonder Stuff. They do that with the Damned. They do that with Populate itself. Like, they have these core fans who just, they would go to every fucking gig they could possibly physically turn up to. And, you know, in America, we had the whole Grateful Dead thing, which, you know, my uncle was in that band for a while. And that was an interesting phenomenon to observe too, from that perspective, from the VIP perspective, you know, and just seeing how a big part of why they kept on the road was because they understood that there was this whole entire culture that was born out of what they were doing. And like it or not, you don't have to be a Deadhead or like Deadheads or any of that. I don't consider myself a Deadhead, but I can appreciate on the cultural level the impact, the lasting impact, the staying power, and the way it really resonated with so many people who created a whole world around it. You know, their thing about the last few tours they did, big part of why they kept on the road when they didn't have to was because they knew that so much of their fan base made a living off of following the Grateful Dead on tour, by setting up in the parking lot and by selling whatever they were selling, whether they're selling acid or weed, or they're selling, you know, mead wine, or they're selling Guatemalan pants, or they're selling hacky sacks or bottles of water, whatever the fuck it was they were selling, they'd be going around selling it all year, every year on tour with the Grateful Dead, just being in the parking lot. So there's this whole economy that exists as a result of them existing, right? And they knew that, and they felt a sense of responsibility around that, let alone the 300 employees they had for Grateful Dead Productions, who all relied on their Christmas bonuses every year. So at this point, you're just staying on the road to keep everyone paid, your fans and your employees. You're grossing $43 million a year in 1993. You're doing all right. You know what I mean? So it was just about keeping this whole world going. You see what I mean? So they really developed a following that literally followed them everywhere. Thousands, by the tens of thousands. So, you know, that's kind of an interesting thing. You don't have to like the music. You don't have to like the fans. But you cannot sniff at the creation of all of this. And the way it's still, even to this day, a huge cultural phenomenon. And that's something for a band to aspire to. Maybe not as hippies, maybe not as heavy metal or whatever. Whatever your style, it doesn't matter. The point is permeating the culture in such a realistic, extraordinary manner, you know? I mean, that's kind of interesting. So, and that is where I see our band having a similarity with their band, not on that same scale, but it's hinting at that. And that is also a thing that keeps me interested, is that, you know, there's this culture that's been born out of it, and this sort of, yeah, this interesting group of people around the world, you know, who have come together through the music. And that was something we were experiencing, you know, from day one with this band. When we were playing gigs in San Francisco, you know, we were kind of a, not, and this wasn't on purpose, but it just kind of worked out this way. We were sort of like a bridge between scenes, and we were sort of like a hub band, you know, like people got connected to a lot of other things through us. And we recognized the power of that pretty early on. You know, we had our own club night. We had bands coming up and playing every Thursday from all over, all different kinds of shoegaze bands, indie rock bands, mod bands, all this kind of garage rock bands, all this sort of stuff. So we really saw that we had this ability to bring people together and kind of create something, make something happen that was exciting and got people going and got people inspired to get their own thing going. And that's what it's all about, you know?
So, how, in terms of early gigs, how far back can you remember? Like, do you remember one of the first ever gigs you did with
the guys? The very first gig we did was at a frat house in Berkeley, California, over the in the East Bay, across the bridge from San Francisco, across the bay. And I was playing drums, and I broke the drum heads. So the show was pretty short. Which was fine because they really didn't want us there anyways. They were looking at us like, oh, who let these faggots in? You know, it was very much like that. And this is literally, you know, over the bridge from San Francisco, but it was like testosterone central. So I think we played about three songs and got the fuck out of there. And then we did another gig. When was the next gig? Oh yeah, the next gig was at the Peacock Lounge, which was an African-American Masonic lodge in the Haight-Ashbury, in the Fillmore district, actually, the Lower Haight, which was more the African-American sort of part of the town where they had housing projects and the whole thing, you know, crack city. It's not like that anymore so much, which, you know, it's a bittersweet result. But we hired that place out because we wanted to play gigs in off the beaten track locations. We weren't necessarily interested in playing the clubs that were pay to play, because back then it was still pay to play. Back then you still had the hair metal thing. You know, Jane's Addiction was still pretty new, so hair metal hadn't really died its death yet. So you still had a lot of people running the show in terms of booking high profile gigs. You know, they want to know that you're going to sell the tickets in advance to your mates and their mates, and that you, and if you can't show us you've sold 100 tickets by the day of the show, we're just not going to let you play the fucking show, even though we told all these people you're playing or whatever. So it was like that. So these people kind of have the leverage over you. So the only way to do that was to be in control of the event yourself. So the only way to do that is to hire a space, hire a sound system, get organized, and make it all happen. So that's what we did. And we did that on a pretty regular basis. In fact, we only started playing shows that weren't in art galleries or Masonic lodges when it was quite evident that we could fill a room. And once we were pretty satisfied with that, we began booking gigs in regular nightclubs. And occasionally we would get an opening slot. Like we got an opening slot from Sonic Boom from Spaceman 3 in a big proper nightclub. So, you know, people started taking note of us, and you know, eventually they had to just embrace it and accept it as a going thing. We were not welcomed by the scene initially because of this whole old school rock and roll record deal politics mentality shit going on. Back then, you'd go out to a gig or you'd go out to a club or whatever, and you'd meet people who were in bands, and they'd be like, oh yeah, we're signed to Island Records, or we're on Geffen Records, or they're on some big ass fucking label, and you've never fucking heard of them. And you never ever did hear of them because their records never even came out. These were people, all these people got speculative record deals, right? They should make a documentary about this, because there's so many bands from the 80s who got these great big record deals, and it was all over before it began. They never even got a record out. Or it was over the day the record came out. Like, okay, your record's out today. It's also deleted today. And now your contract is also null and void today. But we own you. So you can't go out and play gigs as this band anymore without us making the money or you having to pay us money. So they would just put an end to people's careers before the career even went public, before anyone even knew about it. So you'd meet a lot of these people in town, because in San Francisco back then, all the big labels, they had offices in San Francisco too. It wasn't just Hollywood and New York, it was everywhere. They had labels, offices in Chicago and San Francisco and Seattle, they were everywhere, you know? So it wasn't that unusual to be playing a gig and, oh, here's so-and-so from Warner Brothers, you know? That wasn't too weird because they had an office downtown, you know? So it was a climate of record deals, right? And trying to be a rock star, right? So what you got is, you know, this climate of, you know, Guns N' Roses and Jane's Addiction and the Red Hot Chili Peppers, okay? There is no internet. There is no MP3s. There is no CDRs. There's mixtapes, right? There's CDs that cost more than vinyl records, right? This is how it was back then. So the people who were signing these record deals, they were prepared to suck corporate cock and do whatever it took to, you know, to be the next Bono, because that's what the guy who signed them told them they had to aspire towards. You got to be the next Bono, otherwise you're a failure. You got to be the next Red Hot Chili Peppers, or you got to be the next Jane's Addiction, or you got to be the next Guns N' Roses. Now we got grunge. Now you got to be the next Soundgarden or the next Nirvana or the next Pearl Jam. It was all very much like that, right? You had to be sort of pre-packaged for one of these scenes that was sort of in favor at the time, right? And in San Francisco, they had this real preoccupation with kind of thrash funk, you know, like Primus. All those bands really happened there, like the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Primus and Jane's Addiction, all that slap funk bass stuff with distorted guitars. You know, the thing that happened between Guns N' Roses and Nirvana was like this kind of white boys with dreadlocks, and you know what I mean, and they're like, they don't have shirts on, and they're, you know, they're playing heavy metal solos, but they're kind of not that heavy metal, they're kind of more like alterno something. They're, you know, it was really bland and in poor taste, to say the very least. Anyhow, this is what the climate we were born into, right? So just to put you in the picture, like this
paint the picture.
So, you know, our whole thing was like a reaction against that, you know.
Mad.
There was nobody who was, you know, wearing 60s mod clothes but making noisy, spacey, weird, fucked up psychedelic guitar sounds. There wasn't any of that. There was that kind of hybridization wasn't happening in America. It wasn't happening in San Francisco. It was not happening. You know, you had it in England, you had it in Europe, you had it in Australia, but it wasn't happening here, because here it was still, you know, it's California, it's all big money, and it's all about whatever it's going to take to get you, you know, on the Sunset Strip, on the billboard in front of Tower Records or whatever, right? It's very 20th century. Looking back at it now, it's amazing that everyone had to jump through these hoops, because it's just not like that anymore. Anyhow, so our whole thing really was a reaction against all of that. And this is why we weren't even bothering to try to play in the same clubs that bands like that played in, because why pander to that market and that audience? That wasn't what we were about. We were about being too fucking weird and hot to handle and too crazy, you know what I mean? Too unpredictable to even be let into one of those places. We were more punk rock than any punk rock band around, but we were playing melodic, jangly love songs and shoegazy, dreamy stuff, you know? So it was an interesting combination of things people hadn't quite seen yet. They weren't really ready for that. It took them a long time. Just like anywhere else, you know, it's funny how it works. People don't like you in your hometown until they found out someone likes you somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that's true.
How true is that?
Yeah. It's totally true. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's true. It's certainly true of Australian bands. Australian bands are treated with no respect at all until they're read about in the British press. And it's the same kind of thing here, you know. So many people were naysayers with Brian Jonestown until suddenly you're reading about them in magazines because they're on TVT Records. And, oh, wow, you know, they're on this tour. And, oh, there's this article about how their tour went fucking sits up, and it's like everyone around the country is talking about it. And suddenly the band had this gravity, you know, and it had this kind of presence that became evident. You know, you had to just get with this. You don't have to like it, but you have to contend with the fact that it's a real thing and it's not fucking going anywhere. It's other than that. Yeah, that's right. So suddenly, you know, and we started the band in sort of 1990 and started gigging kind of, you know, by late 91, early 92. And then, you know, it wasn't until like 97 or 98 that I started hearing people locally sort of giving the band any real props, you know. And it was only because they were getting props elsewhere. And that's always how it works, you know. And then it's like, oh, yeah, those are our boys. They're from here. Those are our, you know, we own those guys. Yeah, you weren't saying that before, motherfucker. You were talking smack about those guys until you were reading about them in some magazine, and now they're your best mates, right? Oh, I see how it works. Such bullshit. Yeah. Anyhow, that's what we were dealing with.
Gosh, it's fucking true. But I have to show you this. I don't know if I've shown you, Ricky. Look. I ended up getting...
Yeah. You've joined the cult.
It had to be done, mate. It had to be done. Yeah.
You're not the first one. You're not the first one to walk off of living on our bus and then ended up with that on your arm.
Well, listen, there's me thinking I set the trend and I was doing something different.
No, you joined the cult. but it's personalized. Everyone joins in their own way. So,
Mate, honestly, like... I often relive it because, as I said to you at the beginning, it was, fuck me, there can't be that many magicians who have even been in that sort of predicament to be with one of the best bands about. And I've been lucky to do it with a few bands, you know what I mean? But
yeah,
the thing that stood out, I just keep on knocking on that door until it comes open. I don't take no for an answer. If I believe in myself, and you know, I'm one of them people who I couldn't give a fuck if no one else doesn't believe in me. As long as I do, and my mum and dad and my girlfriend do, then that's all that matters, you know.
Yeah.
For all the no's you get, there's going to be one person say yes. And, you know, there's always been a lot of people have said, oh, do you think you'll probably be a bit bigger if you change your image? And I was like, but why would I want to be the same as everyone else? There's a reason why I'm called the Magic Mod. There's a reason why I've stuck by this.
Why do you need to be any different than you are?
Yeah. Exactly, right? Like, I mean, listen, It'd be probably easy for me if I started doing balloon animals and start doing the kids tricks and stuff like that. But I don't want to do that. I want to do what I set out to do, and that's be rock and roll's favorite magician. And I think, fuck, I mean, you can't be more rock and roll than going on tour with a Brian Jonestown Massacre, can you? I mean,
Well,
come on.
I don't know, but when I first heard, I was always going with support acts. Oh, we've got a magician. I thought, a magician. Oh, wow, that's so cool. Because again, because it's not rock and roll. It's not anything. It's something totally different. It's entertainment. It's like, okay, we've got entertainment before us, and it's not going to be a big loud thing. When you know, it's just going to be one guy who's going to be putting on a magic show. Cool. Can't fuck with that. Who else is doing that, right? I thought, great, perfect. I had absolutely no problem with it. The moment I heard it, I just thought, oh, cool. And I met you and thought, okay, this is going to be fun. And
brilliant,
of course
man.
It was, and it was great, and we had a great time. And
brilliant.
Yeah, it was perfect. I was glad you were there. We were all glad you were there.
And I appreciate that because, as I said, you know, every single one of you, and I don't say this lightly, and I truly mean it from the bottom of my heart, I class every single one of you of like family now, because you, every single one of you looked after me as if I was like blood to you, you know. And I remember, even yourself, do you remember we played the Barrowlands, didn't we, one day, and then the next day we played a like a real intimate little club.
All right.
And I remember there was this one time, and me and you were just sitting out at the like the smoking area, and we must have been out there for ages just chatting to each other, like weren't even about the music. I think we were just chatting about like the scenery and all that we went through. It was just like, it was just class, man. And I did must admit, when I got off the tour, it was hard.
Yeah.
Because it was like you've just had this amazing high of being on this bus, and it wasn't even about performing the shows, it was just feeling the connection and the love from everyone.
Sure,
was something that I've never experienced.
The routine. Yeah, because it's a mission, you know. It's a very similar thing, not to compare it to being, you know, a soldier at combat, but they say that that's another thing for them too. When they come home from a tour, it's also called a tour, that they have a bit of a mental, emotional fallout, and it can lead to nervous breakdowns, and it can lead to, you know, this is how people end up on dope and end up alcoholics and end up cokeheads, because they're trying to shift from one reality to another. And it's, you know, no matter how easy you make it look, it's not easy. And so, you know, and not everyone around you understands, so you can't really explain yourself very well to anybody in any effective manner. You know, this is one thing I really miss about my Uncle Vince, who was in the Grateful Dead, was, you know, when I would come home from tours and have the same exact feeling you were talking about, I'd bring him up. Because I knew he knew exactly how I fucking felt. And he could talk me back to earth. He could gently bring me back. You know what I mean? He could kind of finesse it. So my thing was always, you know, you got to have those people. You got to know who those people are, your go-tos. When you're having that transition, when you're in that transitionary limbo thing, you got to ring someone. You got to know who you can ring up who knows exactly how you fucking feel right now. Won't even need you to fucking explain it. They already know who it is when the phone's ringing, kind of thing. You know what I mean? Because those people are very important in our line of work, you know, people who can relate, you know. And sometimes it needs to be someone who wasn't on the tour with you, who does their own tours, but goes through the same experience. So, yeah, and this is something, you know, we've discussed in the band amongst ourselves as well, as, you know, coping with the transition. I know some guys in touring bands, I won't name any names, like a religion, the moment they're off the road, that they are off the bus and into rehab. Even if they don't necessarily need to kick something, it's just their way of transitioning. You know, they just like, okay, I can get off the bus now and go home and be a piece of shit, or I can get off the bus and go to rehab for 2 weeks or 3 weeks and actually get my shit together before I go home. And then I'll go home and I'll already have worked this shit out on my own time, in my own way, right? Not make it anyone else's burden or problem rather than have to explain it or feel alone. I'll just go fucking be alone in the healthiest, safest place, right? Where they're just gonna be looking after me and making sure I'm all right, right? So you just gotta, whatever, you gotta have your methods. Mm. You got to know that it's creeping around the corner when you're coming to the end of a tour, and you just got to be like, okay, what's my plan for this? Who am I going to hang with? You know, some people go on holiday straight away before they go home. They don't just go straight home. They go on holiday first. That's their way of transitioning. Some people go on holiday. Some people go to rehab. Some people don't have those options. They just fucking go home and fight with their girlfriend, or they get on the phone with someone. You know, luckily for me, I had an uncle who already had been doing it for years. So he could, oh yeah, you know, he could tell me exactly how I fucking felt and why and when it would end and all this shit and how to stop it. You know.
Well, for future reference, now I know I can call you now when I'm feeling like that.
I guess in a long-winded way, that's what I'm trying to say, mate, is you can ring me up about that shit any old time you like.
Love that, brother. Love that, man. That's honestly, like I said, it's, I know I'll keep on, you know, sort of going back and reliving them moments, but it was just incredible. And I remember the day when we parked up that bus in London, and I knew, when I first stepped off, I was like, shit, this is the last time, because we finished in Kentish Town Forum, and I knew I had my mum and dad were there, and then I knew the next day I was flying back home to the family, my little boy and the missus, and I was like, oh shit, life's gonna be so shit now. Do you know what I mean? Not thinking like that, but because it ain't. But because you've been doing what you love to do, and as you just mentioned, no one else is going to understand from the outside looking in. They just think, oh,
that's right.
What are you moaning about?
It's like, but I can hurry home to my wife and kid, but what good am I actually going to be to them if I just hurry my ass home? Maybe I should just go chill out for a couple of days and get my head together and then go home. And maybe the wait's worth it sometimes is what I'm saying. You know what I mean?
Do you know, for me, it was like I just had a breakup. You know, when you got your first love and you end up breaking up with him. I remember when I got back home after the tour, Anton gave me a bit of homework. He said, you got to listen to all the albums that we've made, every single album. That's your homework. And I remember just sitting home listening to it going, oh, shit, I remember when they were playing this live. And I was thinking, this ain't helping me. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it was mental. But listen, I'm doing all right.
I think it's okay to relive the moments as long as you're doing it in a constructive manner. Mm. You're looking at the past. You're examining the past so you can understand how to proceed going forward. So as long as it's in some practical way, maybe you go back to it because you're understanding it as this. It's kind of set a bar for you in some way. So you keep deferring to that bar. And that's okay, because you know that's how good it can be. That's how cool it should be. So that's the standard. It's always got to be that fucking good. Otherwise, fuck it, right?
Like, what's the point, eh?
Don't settle for less. That's
exactly that.
So that's when it's okay to be reexamining your previous experiences, because you're trying to maintain a standard of quality in your proceedings and everything you do, right? So, yeah.
Man, listen. I could speak to you for hours upon hours, man, honestly. But like most good things, I think we have to put this one to bed. But I mean, Ricky, honestly, there was so much we could have talked about and so much I could have asked you. But you know what? I've really enjoyed catching up with you, man.
Just be in touch any old time you like, okay?
Top man, brother. And same goes to you. But I wish you. So what's the rest of your day hold? What are you going to do? Just chill out?
Yeah, I'm going to try and keep pretty relaxed, I think. Waiting for some mail to arrive. You know, it's a very hot summer here, so it's good to stay indoors during the day. Might go for a bike ride when it cools off later at night. Go creeping around, you know.
Yeah. I noticed, have you got one cat or two cats?
Four.
Four?
Yeah. Yeah.
Brilliant, yeah, man.
It's Kitty City around here, yeah. Yeah. The humans are outnumbered.
Brilliant, man. Well, listen, I hope I catch up with you soon one day, and maybe when you're next on tour or something, I'm sure we'll be back together. Yeah. Man,
I look forward to it.
Top man.
All
listen,
the best to the family,
and thank you very much for your time this evening here, but your afternoon where you are.
Yeah, my pleasure, dude. Anytime.
Peace and love, brother, and I'll see you soon.
Right on,
babe. Take care. See you later. Peace, man.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.